so important as we try to raise an entire pledge drive's worth of money to pay for the programs you care about in just a single day. And it all starts with a single pledge, yours. So take a few minutes and give at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
So here's the deal. We're looking for 2,000 pledges by 7 o'clock tonight, and we have how many pledges to go, Gina?
We have 885, Kathleen.
All right, we can do that. And our goal this hour is 75 pledges, so your contribution at this very moment will help us get there.
That's right. Your support now pays for the programs you listen to on Wisconsin Public Radio, and it helps us keep our fund drives short. So be part of One Day Wednesday. Give as generously as you can at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
I think that's just about every day. You hear so many substantial topics on the Ideas Network. We know that you want more than just a headline, so we're sure to go in depth on the issues that matter to you. Please make your donation in support of the programs you count on at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And giving to WPR is easy. All it takes is a few minutes of your time, a gift of any amount, say $10 a month.
The donation's going to come back to you every day in the form of great programs. Make your contribution at WPR.org, 888-202-2552. Give as generously as you can. Make your donation in support of One Day Wednesday and the programs that you count on. WPR.org or 888-202-2552, whether your pledge is $5 a month or even $100 a month or anything above, below, in between, we really do appreciate and we count on your gift.
That's right. We can't make it any shorter than this. One day to raise an entire pledge drive's worth of money. It's a risk we're willing to take because we know you'll make it a success. With your pledge of support at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
In just a moment, we'll be talking with, during the course of the hour, some of our favorite programs from the last couple months. We'll talk about World War II. We'll talk about Mrs. Rosa Parks, the drug war, and the Richard III discovery. So all of that's coming up. And discussions like these are possible because of your financial support. WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
That's right. With all that great programming, you certainly feel like WPR is worth $1 million, but you don't have that much to give. Well, that's fine. Don't worry. Your gift of any amount, whether it's $5 a month or $100 a month, whatever amount is comfortable for you, it's the right amount to give. The important thing is to make that pledge right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Our goal is 75 pledges, and we have about 58 minutes, I don't know, something like that. So be a part of this exciting day. It's a one-day deal, so give now, WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And if you're not already a sustainer, become one right now. It's easy to get set up on the ongoing monthly donations from your bank account or credit card at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And just a reminder, Rhonda, could you pass me this beautiful little cup? You can get our 2013 artist mug. It's really lovely. It's a great cup. You'll have it for years. Birds of a feather listen together, very colorful, very artistic. And even if we listen to WPR by ourselves, we're also listening together as a community. $10 a month, you will get this. You can all get together and have coffee and drink out of your cups together. What a day. And listen to the Wisconsin Public Radio. All right. Doesn't get better than that. Pledge WPR.org or 888-202-2552. All right. We are going to play some of the little clips from some of the shows that we found really wonderful. I highly recommend all of Lynn Olson's books. She's a journalist and author. Her books include Citizens of London, The Americans Who Stood with Britain in Its Finest, Darkest, Finest Hour. And most recently, Those Angry Days, Roosevelt, Lindbergh, and America's Fight for World War II. We spoke with her recently about the debate that raged from the White House to Main Street concerning the role that America should play in World War II. The other thing that's really remarkable about your book is this huge, intense debate with all of these fascinating characters that took place during these years, and yet we don't remember very much of this. People don't write about this. It's not in our national consciousness now, and I'm wondering why.
That's really true. I think part of it is that when Pearl Harbor occurred and when we got into World War II, the war was such an overwhelming experience, a defining moment in this country's history and the history of the world, that it just kind of swept up everything that went before it. So these 2 years were very, very important in our history. Basically, we were trying to figure out what we were as a nation. But World War II just kind of swamped it, and nobody really thinks about it that much anymore.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about some of the characters involved in isolationist, interventionist. Some of the people who went on to become president, actually, were very much isolationists, at least early on, weren't they? People like John F. Kennedy, Sergeant Shriver.
Yeah, that's one of the most interesting things I found when I was doing my research. I did not know about this. The main isolationist organization in the country, the most effective, the most influential, was called America First, and it was created in the summer of 1940. And I had always thought of it as a conservative Midwestern organization that basically it was later headquartered in Chicago. But as it turns out, it was actually founded on the campus of Yale University. There was a very big anti-war movement going on among college students to the idea of the U.S. getting involved in the war. I mean, we think now of World War II as, the good war, the just war, the war in which we had to get into in order to help rid the world of Hitler. And that's all true. But back then, back before we got into the war, it wasn't that clear. And a lot of college students, millions of college students, were absolutely opposed to us getting into it. And so this group of young Yale students in 1940 founded America First. And among the founders were Gerald Ford, who went on to become president, Potter Stewart, who went on to become a Supreme Court justice, Sergeant Shriver, who was the first head of the Peace Corps, and a guy named Kingman Brewster, who became later president of Yale, and very ironically, he became an American ambassador to Great Britain. And among those who supported America First, they weren't founders, but they were supporters, was John F. Kennedy, who was a Harvard senior at that point, Kurt Vonnegut, who was at Cornell, and Gore Vidal, who was a prep school student in New Hampshire. So all these people, you'd never in a million years expect them to be isolationists. But as I said, college students, they knew that they were going to be the first on the front lines, and they also felt, we had gone into World War One, 20-some years before. They felt it had been a disaster. We went into that war to help save the world for democracy, and instead democracy gave way to Adolf Hitler. So they just thought, we're not going to do this again.
Right. And what about FDR? Did he know early on that we were going to have to play a significant role in this battle because of the evil of Hitler? What was he trying to balance? Because as many people, probably more in America, felt that we should not be involved in doing much of anything, and so he had to persuade a reluctant public. But was he reluctant as well or not?
He was reluctant. The country was heavily isolationist in the beginning of the period I write about, 1939, certainly into 1940. And FDR had not really paid much attention to foreign policy issues up to that point. I mean, quite rightly, he had been focused on domestic issues from, the beginning of his presidency in 33 up until the late 30s. I mean, what he was trying to do was to get us out of the Depression, and did a pretty good job of it. So he really wasn't focused on foreign policy. He wasn't really focused on Hitler coming to power. And he had done very little to educate the American public about that perhaps we would have to do something to stop Hitler at some point. So when everything heated up, when the war began in September 1939, he was really desperate to help England and France. But I'm not sure he actually thought that we would get into the war. He thought it was absolutely essential, certainly that Britain survive. Once France went down, once the rest of Western Europe was conquered by Hitler, Britain stood alone. And FDR was absolutely determined, or he wanted to keep Britain afloat. But he was feeling his way like the rest of the country was, I think.
Lynn Olson, a recent interview, she's a journalist and author and one wonderful writer. The book, highly recommended, Those Angry Days, Roosevelt, Lindbergh, and America's Fight for World War II. Think of all you learned in just the last 6 minutes. Isn't this something? I'm Kathleen Dunn. Gina Dragutinovich is joining me in our studios in Milwaukee. Today is one day Wednesday.
That's right. This pledge drive is just a single day, and your pledge of $5 or $10 a month makes a big difference. Right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And we're looking, Gina, for another 66 pledges mm-hmm. in the next 45 minutes to help pay for all of the programs that you rely on.
And raising all the money in one day doesn't mean we need less of it. It just means we have to meet our goal faster. So everybody wins when we do. Make your pledge now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
No doubt, you hear great guests all day long on the Ideas Network. It's a unique radio service in this country, and your support makes it possible. Pledge now for the station that you enjoy and you rely on, WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And you know, Kathleen, giving just takes a few minutes of mm-hmm. time, right? So when you call in, please tell us your name, contact information, how much you want to give, and how you'd like to pay. Or better yet, consider using a credit card. It saves time, postage, paper, puts your money to work right away. No matter how you choose to give or how much, take the next few minutes to make your pledge at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Wisconsin has a long and distinguished tradition of community and grassroots support for the things that people care about. All of us banding together are going to be able to make it the best it can be and continue to be there for all of us. So, you know, it's our civic responsibility, I think, to support public radio. I'm Ann Katz. Wisconsin Public Radio is my source for news, connections, and community.
Pledge at WPR.org, 888-202-2552. Your gift may be $10 or $20 a month. Whatever amount you choose is the right amount. Give at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Pledge drives are an important time to hear from new members. That's new contributors. Are you a member yet? And if you aren't, then take that step right now. Go to WPR.org or 888-202-2552 and make a contribution of any amount, say $5 a month. When you do, you make the WPR programs you count on every day possible.
Today is one day Wednesday. We get an entire pledge drive over and done with in just one day. A one-day fun drive means more of your programs and less on-air fundraising in the months to come. Give as generously as you can. WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
That's right. We're looking for, 65 more pledges in the next 40 minutes. And since this is a one-day drive, it's a powerful day, and you have the power to make it a big success. When you give now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
We appreciate our sustaining members who give WPR such reliable monthly support. If you're already a sustainer, we thank you, and you can take part in the One Day Wednesday excitement too. Consider making an additional gift today. Call us at 888-202-2552.
And of course, Kathleen's holding up the mug for me.
She loves this mug. I think it's really a nice mug.
It really is something. Yeah. Yep, it's a colorful, colorful mug. It's our 2013 artist mug, and it's designed by a Wisconsin artist. So with your pledge of $10 a month or more, it's yours. It'll make you happy every time you use it. Request it now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Get one of these mugs. It's got a little WPR car on it, and it says, "Birds of a feather listen together."
Isn't that? That's wonderful.
Gina,
it's true.
I know. Your pledge is important. WPR.org or 888-202-2552. And thank you so much for your support of WPR. Four decades after President Nixon declared a war on drugs, many people were questioning the effectiveness of the initiative. We spoke recently with filmmaker Eugene Jarecki. It was a terrific interview, and his documentary is one that is a must-see. It argues the war on drugs led to the mass incarceration, alienation, and decimation of the social fabric of the black community. Eugene Jarecki is an award-winning filmmaker. The documentary, which you can track down and see, is The House I Live In.
I wanted to show them that the drug war has become an epidemic that affects every corner of this country, whether rural, urban, white, black. I was about to say poor or rich, but that would not have been true because it targets poor people of all types and middle class people all over this country in a way that is running out of control.
So it's a class issue in some ways.
It's entirely become a class issue. Now, it started as racism. I mean, you can say pure and simple that we have drug laws in this country. The first ones we see are in the 1800s, and they are overtly laws against Chinese people. These were the famous opium laws.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I didn't know what they were when I started making the film. And as it turns out, at that time, in the mid-1800s, it was feared that Chinese people were coming over to this country and would be taking American jobs, primarily in California, building railroads and so forth. Well, you couldn't pass a law. People were worried locally. You couldn't pass a law that said it was illegal to be Chinese, but you could pass a law that would address some habit that the Chinese have that special to them, that you could then sort of use as a reason to stop and harass them. And so we passed opium laws. Now, the amazing thing is it passed in so much prelude. It tells us so much about how
yes.
we do this today. We didn't pass opium laws all over the country. We didn't make opium illegal in America. We only made it illegal in California.
Hmm.
And interestingly, at that time, the number one user of opium in America was a middle-aged white woman, usually in the South. And we didn't make using opium illegal in California. We only made smoking opium illegal in California because that was the particular technique that the Chinese used. Now, that was the first racist move where you saw a drug law really being a thinly veiled law of racial control. We've had several more leading up to the present. And over time, that racism has given way, and we can talk about it, to a very fundamental classism in how we implement this.
That particular interview with Richard Lawrence Miller, the American historian, was absolutely fascinating because he went on and talked about, made comparisons almost to the Holocaust, that we're ostracizing people, we learn to hate them, we separate people in ghettos, we confiscate
right.
their possessions, and we concentrate them. And
you know, today is Holocaust Remembrance Day, and I'm a Jewish person whose father fled Nazi Germany in 1939. I lost family
mm-hmm.
to the Holocaust, and my mother's family fled the Tsars of Russia in the turn of the 20th century. So in many ways, a day like today is a day that deeply makes me consider any region in the world in which man's inhumanity to man is on display,
mm-hmm.
in which we are singling out a group of people, targeting them as a kind of source of society's ills, whether they are or they're not, then passing new laws whereby we can stop them on the street, pat them down, search for something. In the case of the Jews in the 1930s, you could be asked for your ID, where yesterday you didn't have to show any ID. Now suddenly there's a new law and you do. And the next thing that happens is you start confiscating those people and their property. And once you do that, you start concentrating those people into facilities. Now, all of this is very clearly what we saw in the Holocaust, and it led, of course, to the next terrible step called annihilation. What Richard Lawrence Miller does in the film is he says, look, if we are to take never again seriously, we are to look at any society in the world that takes any of these steps, that isolates a group of people and pretends they're the problem,
mm-hmm.
that changes the laws so they can be treated differently and be unequal under the law, that we can confiscate them and concentrate them into facilities in disproportion. Well, we've done that in poor communities in America, especially black communities. Black people are 9 times as likely to be arrested on the streets of New York today than white people, even though they use drugs at the same rate.
You also talk about the meth, and that's in areas like Nebraska and Oklahoma, et cetera. Poor white people who, when the economy really went south, had to find a way to make a living, and a lot of them went to meth, right? And now they're in those prisons.
You asked earlier about the racism and the classism. What's happened is that there were drug laws all through time that were racist. Okay, we get that. Then came Richard Nixon. Richard Nixon in 1971 declared a war on drugs. That was a whole other thing that federalized it, and it made crime into a national issue, really for the first time, electorally. Well, the interesting thing is, even though Nixon talked tough on drugs, he actually was very progressive, far more progressive, for example, than Barack Obama. Richard Nixon spent 2/3 of his entire drug budget on drug treatment rather than on law enforcement. That was a small part of what he spent his money on. Yet he knew that on the campaign trail, talking tough won votes.
Right.
So the horrible thing you can say about Nixon is that he knew better, and he was doing better, and he nonetheless coined all of the language of some of the most tough-on-crime rhetoric, and we've been living with it ever since, with politician after politician trying to fit the Nixon mold. Well, where that's led us is an out-of-control war, and a war brings with it something that the previous ad hoc racist drug laws didn't, which is it unleashed the dogs of war, the dogs of corporations, the dogs of unions, the dogs of private pressure groups that come to rely on the continuation of the war. So now that we know the war is a failure, you have to ask yourself, this has been going on for 40 years. We've spent $1 trillion. We've had 45 million drug arrests, and we have nothing to show for it except the record of abject failure. Drugs are cheaper, purer, more available than ever before, and younger people are using them. We have the highest prison population in the world and the highest levels of drug demand in the world, undeterred. Mm. So how could we keep doing this after such a record of failure? Well, the same way we stay in many wars that are failures, because vested interests won't let the war end. And the prison industrial complex in this country is a product of the war on drugs.
Eugene Jarecki, our guest recently, his most recent film is what he was talking about, The House I Live In. It won the Grand Jury Prize for Documentary at the 2012 Sundance Film Festival. Highly recommended film. Very well done. Very interesting and new information to many of us. I'm Kathleen Dunn with Gina Dragutinovich, and today is One Day Wednesday at Wisconsin Public Radio. We are doing an entire pledge drive in one day. Your pledge right now is important because listener contributions make up the largest piece of our budget.
Help make One Day Wednesday a success. Help us raise the money we need in just one day. Give $5 a month, $10 a month. Every gift now, no matter the amount, makes a difference at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
We're looking, Gina, for 51 pledges now in the next half hour, a little over half hour. Mm-hmm. And we can do that. Our hourly goals are really important to make sure that we end One Day Wednesday successfully.
That's right. A gift of $5 or $10 a month is all it takes. Your gift now will help pay for Wisconsin Public Radio listening for the year. Give at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
If you're thinking, maybe you're thinking this now about your tax dollars, federal and state, if you're thinking they already support WPR, you're right, they do, and we thank you for that.
And for you to get the quality and variety of programs you're used to on WPR, we also need contributions from individual listeners. Listener support is actually the single biggest piece of our budget pie.
Right-o.
Mm-hmm. And that means we can't do it without you. Because WPR matters to you, make a personal contribution to pay for the radio programs you listen to at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
It's pretty easy to give. We just need your name, contact information, the amount of your pledge, and how you would like to pay.
Or you can save time and money by using a credit card if you can. Better yet, start automatic sustaining donations directly from your bank account. You choose how to give, and then you do it at WPR.org. Or 888-202-2552.
Hi, I'm Carrillo Owen from Wisconsin Public Radio, and I help create to the best of our knowledge. Did you know that a donation of $10 a month can make a radio show possible? To edit our shows, I use a simple and powerful piece of equipment, headphones. To pay for those headphones and other broadcasting tools, it takes a simple but powerful act. Your support of $10 a month. Here's someone to tell you how.
Very easy. Go to WPR.org, 888-202-2552 to make your pledge of support. You don't like pledge drives? We're with you on this. Let's just do it in a day and have it be successful. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Gina Dragutinovich is with me in Milwaukee, and we're asking for your support. Thank you for your gift in advance. We thank you. $10 or $15 a month, whatever amount is right for you. WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And whether you're already a member or you're making your first pledge ever, Anyone can become a sustainer. Let us know what monthly amount works for you and whether you want that to come from your credit card or bank account.
That easy. Once it's set up, your membership automatically renews, so you don't have to wonder if it's your time to pledge or not. Start your sustaining membership right now at WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
And join your fellow listeners and Wisconsin Public Radio in keeping pledge drives short. If you're already a member, consider making an additional gift today. And if you've never given before, join the community in supporting One Day Wednesday. It's an exciting kind of pledge drive, and it works when you donate at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
We have had a lot of people call in and pledge and comment. I couldn't make it through the day without my faithful companions at WPR. I'm glad you think of it as us as companions, and that's great. And Peter from Madison, I've been a member for many years. Your drive today convinced me that I should become a sustainer.
That's right. It's right on point.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is.
So if you've never given before, know that your new membership will help keep Wisconsin Public Radio strong, the reliable station that you depend on. You decide the amount, $5 or more, then give at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
We really work on an honor system. You don't have to pay for it, but think about what you would pay if you had to pay. Would you pay $10 a month?
That's right. You decide the amount, then go to WPR.org or 888-202-2552. We'll use your gift to support the programs you hear every day on this station.
We're moving along here, Gina. Mm-hmm. We have 42 more pledges we'd like to get before the end of this hour. It's a one-day drive. It works when you take part. So be a part of this day. Give now, WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
And if you're not already a sustainer, like Peter from Madison today, become one right now. You can set up ongoing monthly donations from your bank account or credit card, and you can do that at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. A sustaining membership is convenient for you, and the more sustainers we have, the more stable WPR is financially.
I can't tell you how much I like this 2013 artist mug. You will like it as well. Give $10 or more a month, and you can get the coffee mug. It's Birds of a Feather Listen Together, which means there are birds on this, and that saying is on it, and it's really colorful, and you'll have it, you know, forever. So join the community. Get your limited edition mug with your pledge at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And I think we have time for one more comment. Let's see here. Jane from McFarland said, I travel for my job and always listen in. I love the podcasts for programming that I have missed. So another way to enjoy WPR.
Thank you. Thanks, everybody, for your pledges. I like this one-day thing. You know, if it works, it's good. If it works, it's really, really good. So make it work. WPR.org, 888-202-2552. We're playing just clips from some of our previous interviews that we thought, you know, the kinds of interviews you never wanted to end because they were just so riveting and we learned so much from them. February 4 was the 100th anniversary of Rosa Parks' birth, and her legacy has been really reduced to a refusal to give up her seat to a white man, but she contributed so much to civil rights in the United States over a long period of time. Joining us was Jean Theo Harris, who also has the great distinction of being from Milwaukee. She's the author of The Rebellious Life of Mrs. Rosa Parks, a professor she is of political science at Brooklyn College of the City University of New York. Our guest this hour writes, the reach of Parks' political life embodies the breadth of the struggle for racial justice in America over the 20th century and the scope of the roles that women played. The fable of an accidental midwife without a larger politics has made Parks a household name, but trapped her in the elementary school curriculum, rendering her uninteresting to many young people. But the variety of struggles that Parks took part in, the ongoing nature of the campaign against racial injustice, the connections between Northern and Southern racism that she recognized, and the variety of Northern and Southern movements in which she engaged have been given short shrift in in her iconization. Well, no longer, not with the writing of Jean Theo Harris's book, The Rebellious Life of Mrs. Rosa Parks. Hello, Jean. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's start with the title of this book. I found it interesting that you very carefully chose the title that you did. You called her Mrs. Parks, but you juxtaposed The Rebellious Life of Mrs. Rosa Parks. Why that title, Jean?
I wanted to highlight sort of the breadth of her life, and it was a life of rebellion, of resistance. She calls it a life history of being rebellious. That's her quote. So she really sort of sees her, you know, what we know her for, which is her bus arrest, embedded in a much larger life of struggle, and I would add of courage. And then you mentioned the second half of the title, the Mrs. Rosa Parks. Black women like Rosa Parks, right, were routinely denied that sort of formal honorific. So partly I wanted to put the Mrs. in the title to give that kind of formality, but also to sort of make a stop. I think Rosa Parks rolls off the tongue so quickly that we assume we know her.
Yes.
And so I wanted that degree of formality, I think, to make us kind of realize that we don't know her fully, and that she's not ours fully. I think she's become sort of a national hero, but in many ways, in very narrow ways, and I would argue ways where we often don't stop to sort of see the kind of breadth of what makes her actually a national hero, I would argue.
Mm-hmm. The other thing, you had so much material because, as you write, her life really takes on a whole century, and the work that she did in many different areas in many different parts of the country also takes on a whole century of the struggle for racial justice. It's a huge life.
It's a huge life. Both she lives a very, very long life. Right, she lives, you know,
right,
to be 92, but she lives a very long political life, and so it begins. She is raised by her mother and her grandparents, and her grandfather is a supporter of Marcus Garvey, Pan Africanist, sort of Black nationalist Marcus Garvey. Right, so it begins there. That story begins there. She marries Raymond Parks. Raymond Parks is working on the Scottsboro case when she meets him. The Scottsboro case is nine young black men, ages 12 to 19, who are arrested on a train. Two white women are found on the train, and so the charge quickly turns to rape. The nine young men are sentenced to death, and so a local grassroots movement comes up to try to defend these young men. Raymond Parks, who Rosa Parks describes as the first real activist she ever met, is working on that case when she meets them and when they get married, and so sort of that's where she gets her adult political start, right? So that's the 1930s.
Mm-hmm.
Then the 1940s, 1943, she sees a picture of a friend in a picture of the local NAACP, and she realizes that women can be part of the branch, and so she goes to her first Montgomery branch NAACP meeting, is actually the only woman there that day and elected secretary, and so she will spend a decade before her bus arrest working for the NAACP and working with Edie Nixon, who will come to head the branch, to turn the branch into a more activist chapter. And so they're working on voter registration, they're working on school desegregation, and they're working to document white brutality and legal malfeasance.
Mm-hmm.
So this is very dangerous work that she's doing already in that decade, even before the bus arrest.
Yeah, and after, and we'll get to the bus arrest in a moment here,
yes,
but after the bus arrest, she is, and I don't think that we know this history very well, Jean, she is subjected to all kinds of death threats. It affects her health, her husband's health, her mother's health. And this goes on for a long period of time. What a way to have to live.
Right, and I think we don't often think about the kind of cost or the kind of sacrifice that she makes, right? And sort of how long. I mean, I call it really a decade of suffering in the book because the impact on her, on her family, and their economic health and their physical health sort of lasts really for a decade.
Right. The image that we have, and tell me how we got this, it seems to have been in lots of people's best interest to portray her, including those people who really embraced her, who were part of the movement, of this tired seamstress who was quiet, who was polite, who didn't want to be uppity in any way, who was just worn out, couldn't give up her seat, make her a more sympathetic figure. How does that enter our ideas of who she was and how we remember her when she was really, as you write about so well, so much more?
And I think part of how that enters is, so she is arrested in 1955. We are in the midst of the Cold War, right? And the always civil rights activism sort of was seen as the work of outside agitators and was often portrayed as the work of outside agitators. Very quickly, she is called a communist plant. She is red-baited. She is called an NAACP plant, right? And so in many ways, the movement, sort of Martin Luther King, the Black Press, Parks herself, tend to kind of put forth sort of that she's a Christian, that she's a seamstress, or she's actually, you know, she's an assistant tailor in a downtown department store, that they tend to sort of hold up that aspect of her in many ways as, you know, to keep the movement safe, to keep her safe.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I, you know, and I write about this in the book, she, you know, part of why the community galvanizes behind her is this is a long time coming and there have been many acts. But part of why the community galvanizes behind her is because they know her, they respect her, they trust that she can stand up under the pressure that's going to come onto anyone who makes such a public stand, right? So her politics are key to, you know, one of the keys to why, you know, sort of people rise up in this moment, but they also in many ways are backgrounded to keep the movement safe again because this is sort of the height of the Cold War.
Jean Theo Harris, author of The Rebellious Life of Mrs. Rosa Parks, who joined us actually on the 100th anniversary of Rosa Parks' birth. And Jean is from Milwaukee, as a matter of fact. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Gina Dragutinovich is joining me. We're in Milwaukee, and today is One Day Wednesday. It's your radio station, what you're listening to right now, listener-supported Wisconsin Public Radio, and we're raising money to pay for the programs that you rely on.
That's right. We're raising an entire pledge drive goal in just one day, a single day. And you make it possible when you pledge at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Yeah, make this thing work, okay? Then we can do more of these, and it's much better than these long pledge drives. We're looking for another 28 pledges in the next 15 or so minutes, and we can do that with your help. Your donation of $5 or $10 a month will only take a few minutes. WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And you know, we get such good guests on WPR because they know you'll ask great questions. And they won't be interrupted by commercials either. Your support makes this possible. You are the most reliable part of our budget. So thank you in advance for making your pledge at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Supporting Wisconsin Public Radio at this very moment is a great thing to do with a few minutes of your time. Give us your name, contact information, how much you'd like to give, and how you'd like to pay. Whether you call or pledge online, we will get keep your personal information safe. We don't really share it with any other organization.
Your gift supports the stories and programs that keep you connected to the world. So give now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
You hear examples of powerful voices here on Wisconsin Public Radio. But you have a powerful voice, too. When you give to WPR, you support award-winning radio that inspires and engages a whole state and beyond. You make an entire pledge drive work in just one day with your pledge right now. Here's someone to tell you how.
Make your donation in support of One Day Wednesday Pledge Drive and the programs that you count on. WPR.org, 888-202-2552. Your pledge might be $5 a month, $100 a month, anything above, below, in between. We really do appreciate and we count on your gift.
Consider making a donation of $100 a month to Wisconsin Public Radio. Listener support is crucial to WPR's future. If you'd like to do more than you've done before, consider making that leadership contribution of $100 a month. A gift of any amount is appreciated at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
I think we all crave substance, and yet it can be hard to find. It's one of the reasons you listen, I think, to this program. We really do discuss so many important topics.
That's right, and it's the interviews like those we recently did with Wisconsin veterans, historical topics, national politics, or even international news, and isn't that getting things that aren't getting enough attention elsewhere? You get that kind of information you need right here. This kind of substance is only possible with your support. So make your contribution right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
We repeat, it's a one-day pledge drive. That's why getting 25, we can do this. More pledges this hour. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we can do it. It's important.
So we won't be asking for your pledge tomorrow when we do it today. 25 more to go. 25 today, not tomorrow, the day after, or this weekend. We're asking you today only to help pay for Wisconsin Public Radio listening. Give like there's no tomorrow at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
You may want to consider becoming a sustainer. A sustaining membership is one that's ongoing. It's from your bank account or a credit or a debit card.
And because it automatically renews, you don't have to remember to renew every year. So choose the monthly amount that's right for you. Set it up at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. Some people give $5 a month. Many give $10, $15, $20, or more. The idea is to pick the amount that works for you, make the commitment, and enjoy the ease of giving ongoing support to WPR.
You know, your employer might match your donation. You could double the value of your gift to WPR.
Yeah, and if you don't know whether your employer will match your gift, pledge now and ask your human resources department the next time you get a chance. Pledge your support to this program and to WPR at WPR.org or
888-202-2552. 21 pledges to go, 10 minutes or so to get them. It's a one-day drive. You have the power to make it a big success. You do when you give now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And we really appreciate our sustaining members who give WPR such reliable monthly support. If you're already a sustainer, we thank you. So make today the day you increase your support of WPR by $5 a month or whatever amount you choose. Give us a call, 888-202-2552.
Thanks, everybody, for all of your pledges. Thank you, thank you. Well, this show was one that a lot of people commented on this. Rhonda is a fabulous producer, but she really topped her usual good work with this particular program. This was the King Richard III discovery. He died in battle, as you know, in 1485, and Rhonda was able to round up three individuals from the University of Leicester's Search for King Richard III project. It was a fascinating and incredibly timely program, and let's listen to some of it. Give us a little history here, Matthew. Let's start with you. When did this search for Richard III project begin?
For the Richard III Society, it's been years in the making. For us at the university, since 2011 was when we were first asked to look into finding the location of the Grey Friars Church.
And you were the gentleman, I understand, who discovered the body, actually. Were you the one who thought, no, this can't be the guy?
Well, the problem was we found the body too soon in the excavation. Uh-huh. We hadn't found the friary. So it wasn't particularly a surprise in that we were looking for a church. We were expecting to find human remains. And until we actually started the excavation itself, we weren't expecting it to be anything more than just one of the many people buried in that church.
Mm-hmm. And when did you realize, Matthew, that you had something extraordinary?
Probably it was the very last thing, really. We'd found the trauma on the skull sort of fairly on in the excavation, but we'd sort of second-guessed ourselves, really, and thought, oh, anyone could have got hit on the head. It wasn't until we found the vertebrae themselves, the twisting of the vertebrae, and that was the very last thing we found on the skeleton that we sort of had this moment where we thought, good grief, we may have actually done this.
Mm-hmm. And it must have been, just in the scheme of history, in a history timeline, quite a remarkable discovery as well, isn't it, to have that kind of big find from somebody who we've seen plays about for so long and is written about, and there he was because we didn't know where he was. So historically, it was a huge find.
Well, it's certainly very exciting. I get asked this a lot, and in terms of what it's contributed to archaeology, maybe it isn't as important as, say, Tutankhamun or something, but it's certainly one of the most exciting finds in recent years.
Mm-hmm. How important was it to find a direct descendant of, I believe it was Richard III's eldest sister, to confirm DNA? Is that when you really could pinpoint and say that this is Richard III?
Well, I think from our point of view, it was the icing on the cake. All the other evidence, and you have to take all the evidence together, was so compelling that even without the DNA, I think we'd have probably concluded that we'd found Richard III. But having that extra source of evidence, the genetic evidence, was really clinched it.
Mm-hmm. Sarah and Marianne, if you would both talk about this, our vision of Richard III is of this man with a horrible deformity, a left arm that is terribly withered. Did the discovery of the body reaffirm what we have heard about, particularly in Shakespeare?
Well, I think that you've got to take Shakespeare as well as the earlier Tudor histories, which depict Richard's physical disabilities. Certainly there's evidence that Shakespeare exaggerates a great deal. And when you set that against the remains, well, for the first time, really, you're able to compare the literature, the history, and the archaeology.
Absolutely. And what's interesting is that some things are borne out in some ways by the discovery, but other things, there's no evidence at all. For instance, there's no sign that he had this withered arm. Shakespeare has him walking with a limp, and there's no sign of a limp. So it does show how history and literature diverge, as well as the truth that they do have in common.
Mm-hmm. Sarah, we think of him as one of the largest villain in all of literature. He is portrayed as an incredibly, in many performances, incredibly evil person. Is that true about him, or do we have any historical knowledge of what kind of king he actually was?
We do have quite a lot of historical records, which you've got to weigh against each other and always look at who's writing them and what their agenda might have been.
Mm-hmm.
To deal with the idea of villainy first, there's no doubt that Shakespeare's portrait has cemented Richard as that villain in the popular imagination, if you like, and that performances of the play have, I mean, for example, Laurence Olivier's performance mid-20th century have helped to cement that view. But what you get from the historical sources is a somewhat more complicated picture. Certainly some of the earlier Tudor sources do emphasise what they represent as Richard's bad qualities. But the other thing to point out, I suppose, is that while Shakespeare undoubtedly is creating a villain, he's also creating a tremendously charismatic and eloquent character at the same time. So he's not a cartoon baddie, if you like.
He does have some pretty good lines, doesn't he?
He absolutely does. From the very beginning of the play, "Now is the winter of our discontent," Richard takes the stage and holds it. He has this wonderful soliloquy, a monologue on his own on the stage. And I think right till the very end, for the you know, horse, a horse, my kingdom for a horse, Richard's the one that we're watching and we're magnetized by, I suppose.
What will, if anything, the discovery of the body and the shape of the body and what we've learned about how he died in battle do to change the historical record about Richard III? Will it add to our knowledge of him in a significant way?
It's going to add to our knowledge of how he looked. Certainly the facial reconstructions are absolutely fascinating and have a pretty close resemblance with his portraits. It's going to tell us quite a lot more about the exact circumstances of how he died. The historical accounts all talk about him being killed in the thickest press of the enemy of his enemies, and that's Polydore Virgil, shortly after Richard's death. So we can see from the trauma on the skeleton that he was really hacked about.
Mm.
It's not going to tell us anything more about his character, of course, and that's significant.
Mm-hmm. Can you add to that, Matthew, can you talk more about the discovery of the body and how we learned about his war wounds?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the individual, we're going to learn a lot about his physical appearance, his diet, what happened to him in the very last moments. But in a wider context as well, because we know who this person is, we have a name and a set of a life to go with it, which we is incredibly rare to be able to find in archaeology. Most of the skeletons we excavate, we'll never know who they were. We can't put a name to them, and therefore we can't put a biography to them. In this instance, everything we learn from Richard's skeleton in terms of diet, in terms of health, these are going to give us a brilliant baseline against which we compare other unnamed individuals. So how does his diet vary as a king and someone of very high status? How does his diet vary from people of very poor status, possibly? Can we tell differences? And that is going to be the genuine contribution to archaeology, I think, in this.
That was the voice of Matthew Morris. He is the archaeologist who first uncovered the remains of Richard III. And the other two guest lecturers in Shakespeare and Renaissance literature at the University of Leicester, where they had the Search for King Richard III project. I love that show. That was just a terrific show. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for well, she does a lot of production, but that one was just... I have to go back and listen to that whole thing again sometime. It was so good. Well, here we are, and here we are. I'm Kathleen Dunn with Gina Dragutinovich. Today is One Day Wednesday, and we're doing all right here. We need 10 more calls, and we'll make our goal this hour. So let's get 10 calls, make our goal. Everybody will feel great. We rely on you to give... to keep that news and all these discussions going on.
That's right. We're here to raise the money for the programs you rely on with just one day of on-air fundraising. Make your pledge of any amount right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Nine now. We need nine pledges to make the goal this hour. Just a few minutes to do that. I think we can do this, Gina. And instead, mm-hmm. Look at this. This is a great thing. Instead of a week of fundraising, it gets really boring. This fund drive is only going to last one day.
The needle's moving. Eight more to
All
go.
All right, good.
Here we
thanks.
Go. So we're asking you to help us meet this goal, to help pay for the programs you rely on. Please make your gift now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
It just takes a couple minutes to do this. And I did want to say this, Gina. Christina from Evansville, you know, listening to that Richard III, she's a teacher, listens to WPR each day, and it helps her talk to her students about the day's issues in a clear and unbiased way. You know, you could use something like that, Richard III. Just bring that conversation into your classroom,
absolutely.
Too, because it was absolutely fascinating, and you don't get better guests than that. I will. It's good. Now, your pledge, it's a one-day pledge drive. Your pledge online, WPR.org. Very helpful right now as we try to reach our goal. We need eight more pledges. Support the programs you rely on, WPR.org. And, of course, you can pledge by using your telephone, 888-202-2552.
That's right. Maybe you found yourself thinking about something in a way after you've heard it that you never had before,
right,
after listening to one of our shows.
Mm-hmm.
Or the classroom example. Excellent example. And that's the beauty of the ideas networks. You get lots of ideas. You hear many points of view. If you value what you hear on the Ideas Network, your pledge of support now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And thank you so much for all of your pledges. Really, we can't do all of this without you. We need you. We need eight more pledges right now. Would you do that? So we'll really
That's right.
That'll make us very happy.
A little bit to go.
Yeah. And here's how you do it. WPR.org, 888-202-2552. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Kitty Mattson. Thanks, Gina.